call the House Finance Department Law Budget Subcommittee to order. It's Tuesday, February 7th at about 10:36 a.m. Present, we have Representative Stoltz, Representative Keller, Representative Ledoux, myself, Representative Holmes, and Representative Josephson. And today, we are going to be talking to the Civil Division, primarily oil, gas, and mining component about major state litigation. And I think in front of you all, you should have a handy-dandy chart, which kind of summarizes the major litigation, as well as some additional information on the section. We have Jim Cantor in front of us. Welcome.
Thank you. Jim Cantor, Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division. Today we're going to hear from Martin Schultz, who is the supervisor of the oil, gas, and mining section in our office. And I'll tell you a little bit about Martin because he won't. He's an Anchorage boy, service high, I believe.
Sorry.
He's got a string.
Well.
Yeah. He and I were actually summer associates together in a law firm before we graduated from law school. We later, after we graduated, started working with the same law firm. And then the way careers move around in different pathways, we're back together again. He's got an accounting background. He's worked for ARCO. He's worked in private practice. He's been in-house for a small business. He's worked for Department of Revenue. He's worked for AG offices in two different states. He brings a lot to the table and started working in this capacity for us about a year ago after Tina Kobayashi left. The oil, gas, and mining section provides the advice that keeps the revenue coming that largely funds state government. So it's not just major litigation. There's an ongoing advice kind of keeping the gears moving component. And, you know, after last week, I was thinking that, you know, they're the section that funds that child protection and all the other sections that we were talking about. And there's even a bigger nexus in that they work not just on, you know, today's disputes, but they're working on the leasing and the exploration plans and whatnot for the future, so that should Carla Raymond, who talked last week, and OCS save a child, when that child becomes an adult, they can get a job and move forward as Alaskan citizens. So it's really a key position in the state.
I'm going to interrupt you for 2 seconds. We've been joined by Representative Groenberg.
With that, I'll let Martin take over. He's going to tell you about the section and about the major litigation.
Thank you, Jim.
Don't make it too technical. There's two of us that aren't lawyers here. Chugiak, so.
Yeah. You can try to play that card, Bill. Welcome.
Thank you, and good morning. We did pass out a major litigation spreadsheet, and we'll get to that. But I wanted to tell you a little bit about the section, the kind of work that we do, who our clients are, what kind of matters we're involved in. As Jim said, we're the section that deals with most oil and gas issues at the Attorney General's office and protecting the state's proprietary interests in oil and gas revenues. And that would include the royalties that we get from state production, the three types of oil and gas taxes that we have, the corporate income tax, the production tax, and the property tax. We provide advice to our clients and also represent them in administrative appeals and in court actions. We also intervene in certain federal cases relating to, for example, efforts to develop the Outer Continental Shelf in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. We intervene in some of those lawsuits on behalf of the state because the state has a story to tell with respect to federal oil and gas development, and the federal courts have been receptive to that. So basically, I thought I would explain a little bit about the makeup of our section. Of course, we're in the Civil Division. We're in two different locations. We have an office here in Juneau. We also have an office in Anchorage. We have 15 attorneys, 6 paralegals, and 4 law office assistants. And those are spread between those two offices. There are other sections that also work on oil and gas work, not just our section. For example, our natural resources section works on oil and gas permitting issues relating to land use and things like that. The environmental section works on issues relating to Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and other kinds of state environmental issues. So we don't do everything with regard to oil and gas. Some other sections are also involved in those kind of issues. We have a number of state agency clients. One of our main clients is the Department of Natural Resources. We advise the Commissioner's Office and also two different divisions within the department, the Division of Oil and Gas and the Division of Mining, Land, and Water relating to mining issues. We also advise the Department of Revenue, the Commissioner's Office, and the Tax Division that administers the three different types of taxes that I mentioned, production taxes, corporate income taxes, and property taxes. We represent the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission that's responsible for, you could think of it as below the ground sort of measures like drilling permits, well spacing, maintaining adequate reservoir pressure, making sure that we produce our resources in a wise manner that conserves the resources and produces the maximum amount of resources from the reservoirs. We also represent the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, which monitors pipeline right-of-ways in Alaska, including the TAPS pipeline corridor. It issues right-of-way leases to companies that are interested in building pipelines or extending their right-of-way leases and otherwise monitoring pipeline corridors. We also represent what's called the Gas Pipeline Project Office, which is the state AGEA coordinator for the large export AGEA gas pipeline, and that's part of DNR, but has a separate office. So the subject areas that we're involved in, we just looked at the clients, but the subject areas are taxes, and I have a number of tax cases on this major litigation spreadsheet, and I'm prepared to answer any questions you have about them. But for example, one thing that we've had in the last few years are TAPS property tax cases, and that's something that's come up in some legislative hearings, Judge Gleason's decisions in those property tax cases relating to the assessed value of the TAPS pipeline, and all sorts of different issues relating to the TAPS pipeline, including production forecasts and those kind of things. And that's something that has involved a lot of discovery, a lot of depositions, a lot of trial work on behalf of attorneys in our section. We are also involved in production and corporate income tax cases, and those typically start as administrative appeals before a state agency called the Office of Administrative Hearings. That's typically the forum where they start. And they're actually confidential at that level under state law, and then if those are appealed to Superior Court and the Supreme Court, then they're no longer confidential, but we handle all those cases in our section. We also handle royalty cases, and royalty cases, there's basically two different kinds of state leases.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, President Stoltz.
What's the difference? Is there a difference between an administrative hearing and a process before an ALJ? And can you help me out on that?
An administrative hearing typically does involve an administrative law judge, and it may or may not include a full evidentiary hearing before that administrative law judge, like a trial, not as formal in terms of some of the procedures in the administrative appeal. Sometimes in an administrative appeal, they're just briefed so that each side submits a brief on the legal issues that are involved. And if there's no facts in dispute, there doesn't have to be a hearing. But the administrative law judge would decide based on the briefing, the different issues that were involved in the case. But it's somewhat like a trial. I mean, the same thing can happen in court where you submit briefs if it's a pure issue of law and you don't ever get to a trial. but it's similar to a trial-like setting, but just it's a state administrative agency with administrative law judge that decides it.
So it may or may not involve an ALJ, Madam Chair?
Well, it typically would involve, Representative Stoltz through the chair.
We're kind of formal in the subcommittee process.
I appreciate that. Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, it typically would involve an ALJ.
Okay.
It has to involve a decision maker.
Sorry to.
These are good questions. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. On that, I assume that you wouldn't have a hearing as opposed to oral argument. You wouldn't have a hearing unless there's some non-documentary testimonial evidence you need, which wouldn't be introduced by depo or at affidavits or something, right? Just like any other proceeding, right?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, it could be that in some cases we utilize pre-filed testimony instead of live testimony. So even if there were some facts involved that we wanted to get in front of the ALJ that could even potentially be in dispute, we might do them through pre-filed testimony.
Is that like a depo, or is there a difference?
You have to swear to the pre-filed testimony that it's accurate and that kind of thing, but it doesn't involve questions that are put to a witness. It's more akin to direct testimony. In other words, the lawyer works
it's
with...
It's like an affidavit, but in question and answer form?
It's more like an affidavit in question and answer form. That's correct, Representative Grunberg.
And then does the other side have a right to cross-examine that?
Typically, yes.
I see. Okay, and I have a couple of other questions, too. You mentioned, I think it was in your statement concerning the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, that you represented the division. Is that the, in the sense, like for the RCA and the Internal Revenue Service and stuff, is that advising the commission, or is that representing a party, basically? If so, how do you divide the functions? Is there a firewall between the two functions in the Attorney General's office? How do you avoid a conflict of interest?
Yes, Representative Grunberg, through the chair. We do represent the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation, the commissioners, and their staff. And we have one attorney that's dedicated to commission work. And that attorney is in our section, but does not communicate relating to those kind of matters with other attorneys that could potentially represent DNR before the commission, for example. And
is there a firewall or something to be sure that records aren't crossed over and stuff?
We have an internal firewall, and we do not violate that firewall.
Okay. And then you mentioned a little earlier in your testimony that you represent folks, you represent the state on appeals to the court. Are the hearings and the procedures before these agencies, let's say before the commissioner, are there attorneys involved in that? And if so, are they Department of Law? Or do you just come in at the time the thing goes on appeal under the appellate rules to the Superior Court?
We, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, we do represent the department in those appeals and follow them up to the Superior Court and the Supreme Court in defending whatever the department's decision is.
The reason I'm asking is, so you do get You get involved in administrative appeals before the court, right?
That's correct.
How early do you get involved in the process? Because I know that, like in a practice where you're in litigation and there may be an appeal, a good appellate lawyer gets involved everything from the drafting of the pleadings to summary judgment, so that the appeal or the defense of the appeal is set up from the get-go. And even in the strategy before there's a document filed, how early do you guys get involved?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I think you're highlighting that sometimes early attorney involvement is a good thing because it can shape what the agency does before you get to litigation.
Put you in the best position possible.
Yes, and we certainly endeavor to do that, and we work on a daily basis with our clients, telephones, emails. A lot of what we do is advice to the agencies. I mean, an important part of what we do is litigation, but at least half our work is on the phone every day and talking to our clients.
That's great. Thank you.
And before we start up, we've been joined by Representative Pruitt.
In going through the different types of matters that our section handles, royalties is a big part for the Department of Natural Resources. And Deputy Attorney General Cantor mentioned about how the future is important to us. And royalties, of course, are administered by the Division of Oil and Gas, which is part of DNR. That is kind of like the state's oil company, because they're involved in everything from leasing to forming units, groups of leases to explore and develop a resource, forming participating areas, everything that goes into all the initial work well before production would ever occur and development would ever occur. And we're involved in all those things, including revising from time to time the oil and gas lease forms. And the oil and gas lease forms contain the royalty percentage that the state gets, which is it's basically the state share of production that it's reserving to itself from leases on state lands. So that's part of what we do. There's kind of two vintages of leases. There's leases that were issued before 1980, which are called DL-1 leases. That's just the name that's on the form. And then there's leases that were issued since 1980 that are called new form leases. And they're slightly different in terms of the measurement of the royalty that the state gets. The DL-1 leases are largely in what are called royalty settlement agreements, which are an outgrowth of some historic litigation called the Amerada-Hess litigation that started soon after the pipeline started flowing oil. And so a lot of the production off the North Slope is subject to these royalty settlement agreements. Those are subject to, they're different for each company, but they describe the formula under which the company pays its royalty to the state. And those are subject to periodic reopeners. So in other words, either side can say something's changed. Transportation costs have changed. Market conditions have changed. So there's reopener provisions, which are beneficial to both sides, both the lessees and to the state, so that each side has an opportunity to explore current conditions. So in other words, it's a living document. And a lot of our work relating to royalties involves these reopeners. We don't always reopen, but sometimes it's appropriate, and sometimes these cases go to arbitration. Then we also have leases that the royalties are paid subject to the lease terms. They're not part of any royalty settlement agreement. And DNR does audits of the royalty reports, and then we can get involved in some of the appeals relating to those kind of audits. And that's some of the cases that are on this spreadsheet that you have. We also do work with DNR relating to units and leasing issues. Probably the Point Thompson unit litigation is the most famous recent case relating to all that. And thankfully, the parties have settled that litigation, and Exxon is making great progress in developing that field, and we're very optimistic about the prospects at Point Thompson. We also work on pipeline tariff cases. As you probably know, the producers deduct the cost of transporting the oil or the gas to the market where they're selling the oil or gas. Most of the oil produced on the North Slope is sold in California and Washington to refineries on the U.S. West Coast, and they're allowed to deduct their marine tanker costs and their pipeline tariff costs to get it off the North Slope to their market. So we're very interested in the pipeline tariffs because it's a deduction for both production taxes and royalties. So we monitor pipeline tariffs very carefully in our section. And the first matter on the major litigation report that you have in front of you relates to some ongoing tariff litigation we have right now relating to the TAPS pipeline before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and also the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I've mentioned that we represent the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission on a variety of matters.
Actually, if we could just stop for a second on the TAPS case. I know that's yes. That's been taking up a lot of time and resources. Can you give me a better feel for how much, what kind of impact that's having on your division?
Yes. Well, it's one thing that our section asks for is money from the legislature for outside counsel and experts. Mm-hmm. And this is a good kind of segue into that because this is a case where we need outside counsel that are specialized in FERC law, the federal pipeline tariff law. We utilize them heavily in this case. We also have seven experts in this case that are engineers, economists, pipelines operations people, disciplines of that nature. This is a case that we've had 45 days worth of hearings. We've had 700 pages of briefing. We've had extensive discovery, 15 million pages worth of discovery relating to the Alyeska Strategic Reconfiguration Project. So it is something that you know, it's important work. It's work that has consumed section resources, and it's important to the state because it is a deduction for both production taxes and royalties.
Representative Ledoux, then Representative Stoltz.
Did you just say 15 million pages of discovery?
Yes, I did. We have cases in the oil and gas arena where we do have extensive discovery, many depositions, very voluminous discovery, sophisticated databases to manage all of the discovery and to actually find something in that 15 pages. So that's all resources that are necessary to prosecute these kind of cases.
That
follow-up.
That's mind-boggling. It's just mind-boggling.
Representative Ledoux through the chair, I agree completely. It is.
Yeah, there's a reason I wanted to stop on this one.
I couldn't believe that what I was hearing was correct when you said 15 million.
Yes, it's a case that's gone on since 2005. So, multi-year litigation, but we do see some light at the end of the tunnel because the FERC administrative law judge is. The next step is to issue what's called an initial decision, and we're expecting that within the next several months. So even though these things go on for years, eventually you do get a resolution.
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Your perspective of being in and out of the private sector and back and forth, I suppose, have you done contract work with the state and your other
functions? I've never been a contract attorney for the state. I started with the Department of Law in 1993. As the Deputy Attorney General mentioned, I did work for ARCO before law school as a revenue accountant here in Anchorage, rather, and also worked for a private law firm.
Yeah, and I wasn't scouting your biography. I was just trying to preface a question. We get kind of a... It's almost like a rote annual interrogation of the Mr. Cantor and his predecessors. There's people that have a pipeline to something in your department, have a pipeline to hypothetically a member of our finance committee, are always complaining that we're excessively spending on contract lawyers. What's your perspective, having been in both capacities?
I think that
in the efficacy of having the people on staff, keeping career people that have the same expertise. Just if that it's going to come up, and it's It's a theological sermon we have to listen to a few times, and I just want to have a little better understanding of the theology.
of who's in-house counsel for the state versus use of outside counsel, and when it makes sense and how we're doing that.
Yeah, what she said.
Yeah.
Well, my mouthpiece. My
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, I think that's a great question, and it's one that we should always wrestle with. How much should we do in-house? How much should we contract for? The money that we seek for outside counsel and expert funds isn't just for outside counsel. It's also for experts. And so that's money that we would have to spend no matter who did the case. And we do use experts extensively depending on the case. So we may need reservoir engineers. We may need economists, we may need engineers, we may need different kinds of experts, appraisers in the TAPS property tax case. So that's money that we would need no matter which attorneys were handling it. But with regard to whether or not to use an attorney within our section or to use contract counsel, we use contract counsel when it's a matter that there's some expertise that we need that we don't have in-house anywhere within the Department of Law. And one example would be counsel that are experts on pipeline tariff law at the federal level. We have attorneys that within our office that obviously know a lot about state pipeline law, but not about FERC or federal pipeline law. So we may need help, and I think it behooves the state to, on these large complex cases where we don't have the in-house expertise, to get that kind of help, because there's a lot of money involved in these oil and gas cases. We are facing outstanding, very competent counsel that the oil companies employ, both their in-house counsel and the outside firms that they bring to these disputes. And I think it's money well spent by the state in appropriate cases to hire counsel that are experts in a certain area where we don't have the expertise, and to make sure that the state is getting the quality of legal services and representation that we should be getting.
And, yeah, Madam Chair, I asked that question with a well-documented appreciation for the skill set of attorneys we have within our division that have chosen to work for the people. Often, they've made economic decisions and. To do that, and that, I just wanted to make sure that question was framed in that manner. I have a deep appreciation for the quality of attorneys we are able to attract, given the competition for that valuable resource and skill set.
Well, Representative Stoltz, through the chair, I agree completely. I think the oil, gas, and mining section has very competent attorneys, very hardworking attorneys, dedicated attorneys that do whatever it takes in terms of representing the state on a case. But there are times that we do need outside counsel, and always will.
Thanks for
mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Representative Ledoux.
I guess I was just wondering, so if you've got a case that is that you need to retain outside counsel because you don't have the expertise in-house, and it appears that it's going to be a case that's going to last like for 10 or 15 years. At some point during this process, do you consider hiring people in-house to do the job that, or if a law firm takes the case, that unless you can actually lure one of them over to work within the department, that you just keep it with the same counsel? I mean, how does that work?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, if it was a case that we knew we were regularly going to have in the section and that it would consume at least one attorney indefinitely, then that would be an issue that one would consider. Should we develop that expertise in-house? One thing I would say is, even in cases where we use outside counsel, we don't just hand it off to outside counsel. There's always at least one assistant attorney general that's working in the case that makes the decisions relating to case strategy, an important case decision. So it's, we are actively working the cases, every case, even if we are using outside counsel. But you're highlighting a good issue, which is if we had a recurring need that we thought was going to continue indefinitely, then that's a decision that, that would be appropriate to make. We don't always know whether certain specialized types of litigation are always going to be there, whether they're always going to take up an entire person's time indefinitely, you know, some of those kind of issues. I suspect that inevitably there's always going to be a need, you know, for some amount of outside counsel help.
Yeah. Representative Josephson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm somewhat familiar with this, and I think there's a good track record. In the 80s and 90s, there were a couple of firms hired on L Street in Anchorage that probably generated fees of tens of millions of dollars, but they also brought in royalty and tax settlements well in excess of $1 billion. So I think the history of this has been pretty good. Is that fair?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, I think it is fair. I think that we have, we have spent the money wisely with the amount of money at stake in mind, and I think you're right that our track record is that we've employed outside counsel wisely. Another thing about outside counsel is they can be very expandable. If you have like the document discovery that we were talking about earlier, they're equipped to handle lots of depositions and lots of discovery in a hurry, where we might have to dedicate everybody in our section and pull them off other work to do that, for short spurts of time, short meaning 6 months or something like that. But I think you're right that we have employed outside counsel wisely, and we endeavor to do that. Mm-hmm. And I would also say the vast majority of the section's work is handled by our in-house staff.
One follow-up is that I'm sort of familiar with some of that litigation, and the other thing those outside counsel were able to do was to organize these tremendous libraries that I assume the state took possession of and that are just must be absolutely invaluable. I know that it would have been difficult for the AG's office to have something done with that much detail. Just the sheer space of it, physical space that was required.
Representative really Josephson, through the chair, I agree, and the Amarada Hess case is one of the cases that you may be thinking of, and that's right, where there's voluminous material and they were able to organize it in a fashion that, you know, that the private firms are equipped to do, and that's very helpful to that kind of a case.
Going back to the TAPS case, the tariff case in particular, it looks like on the spreadsheet it says that the initial decision is anticipated maybe in March or April of this year, and that and then there will probably be some appeals on that. Do you think, I know it's an imprecise crystal ball, but do you think if we're sitting here at this time next year, we'll be saying, okay, this is totally behind us, or will some of these things still be outstanding? I'm not going to hold you to it 100%.
Chairman Holmes, I would very much hope for that, but who knows? As you know, litigation, it just depends. I mean, the ALJ's decision will be reviewed by the full FERC commission, and the RCA, you know, will have a similar process for the decision that they render. And then the parties could appeal it to the D.C. Circuit if they don't like the commission's decision. It's also always possible with any litigation, as we know, that litigation can settle. And we have, you know, that's certainly not unprecedented with regard to pipeline tariff litigation that the state's been involved in the past. And so any of those things could happen. So we could be in the midst of an appeal next year this time, or something else.
We could be in the middle of an appeal to FERC. We could be in the middle of the D.C. Circuit. We could be anywhere. Okay.
Yes.
That's the answer I was looking for. Okay. All right. Moving on.
To the next subject area is gas line work. And that's something that our section works on. And, of course, there's the AGEA gas line project, the major export pipeline. And TransCanada is our AGEA licensee. And TransCanada and the producers right now are looking at concept selection for a potential LNG project from the North Slope to somewhere in South Central Alaska, and making progress with that. And we're working with our state agency clients, namely DNR and Department of Revenue, and the Gas Pipeline Project Office on the AGEA gas line, and also coordinating efforts with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to utilize to the extent that the parties are able to information that they might have in common to avoid duplication of costs and coordination of those projects. So that's another important area looking to the future of Alaska's oil and gas development is a gas line from the North Slope, both for in-state use and to provide a new revenue stream for the state of Alaska.
So stopping there for a minute, because it's, as you said, another huge one. So we've seen sort of some consistency over the last few years in terms of, you know, the budget allocated to this. If one of these projects were to really heat up and start moving forward, I mean, I know they're all moving forward, but I mean, if they were to start, permitting.
It's not like DOT fast, though.
then what kind of impact would that have on the on the division?
The Chair Holmes, that's a good question, and actually we have not spent our entire appropriation for this year, fiscal year 13, and it was based on the activity that we anticipated would happen this year, but there's been a little bit of a change because the route of the pipeline has changed from an Alberta route to a South Central Alaska route. So the level of activity that we anticipated for this year hasn't happened, so we haven't spent our entire appropriation. But we have asked for roughly the same level of appropriation for next year because we're anticipating that those activities will occur during fiscal year 2014. And you're certainly right that we will have a greatly increased level of activity depending on how the projects play out and the things that we're doing at that level of activity.
I know it's, again, crystal ball, but can you give us some sort of order of magnitude in terms of what kind of resources, both monetary but also in terms of people, it would take to go through permitting and other issues moving forward?
Well, our client, Chair Holmes, our client agencies would do the permitting and we would advise them on some of the permitting issues. I don't anticipate that we would need new attorney positions in the oil, gas, and mining section, but we would need money for specialized outside counsel. It's possible that FERC would regulate parts of this project, and so our FERC counsel would help us with that and other issues relating to different ways the state could potentially be involved in a project like this.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schultz, relative to the page 3 of 7 of your spreadsheet, the Point Thompson unit, could you remind me, I'm sure it's complicated, but the Superior Court in that case at one point found that Commissioner Irwin shouldn't have sat as both sort of a party to it as well as an adjudicator of it. And is there something legally that the legislature should do or to remedy the process that occurred in round one of that? Am I making any sense?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, you're highlighting some due process considerations that the court had about a DNR person being present in Superior Court and then going back when the case was remanded to DNR and being in basically an adjudication role at that administrative proceeding. And we have certainly noted the court's guidance relating to those due process issues, and we're mindful of that and trying to reflect that going forward. But I don't believe, in answer to your question, that there's anything that the legislature needs to do. I think the court system has spoken, and we've listened, and we'll go forward with that guidance from the court.
Okay. And it looks like that one is currently in front of the Supreme Court.
The Point Thompson case was argued before the Alaska Supreme Court at West High. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience because students from all over Anchorage could attend the Supreme Court argument at West High. And it's something the court does from time to time, and a great educational experience for the high school students. Shortly after the, and it was argued, by the way, by Senior Assistant Attorney General Richard Todd, who's a very experienced member of our section and who did a fantastic job at that oral argument. So that was argued by a member of our section. And but shortly after the Alaska Supreme Court argument, the state and the Point Thompson lessees settled the Point Thompson litigation. And since that time, so that litigation is over. The settlement agreement itself has been challenged. We prevailed in Superior Court in that challenge, and the plaintiff in that case filed an appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court, and briefing hasn't started yet on that case, but we're confident of our position that the settlement agreement is valid. And under the settlement agreement, Exxon has agreed to certain development goals. Exxon is the operator of the Point Thompson unit, and they're proceeding with that, and they're hiring Alaskans and Alaska firms, and we're very excited about that, and it's good to have that litigation resolved.
Absolutely, Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Chairwoman, Madam Chair. How did the intervener in this settlement litigation, how did they get standing to challenge the settlement? Who was this? Who is this?
Bill Walker is the plaintiff, and Representative Josephson through the chair. What the Superior Court decided is that it was styled as an appeal of the settlement agreement, which was signed by the Attorney General and the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Dan Sullivan. And the appeal was styled as an appeal of that execution of that agreement to Superior Court. And the Superior Court basically said in its decision that the court does not have jurisdiction over that kind of, there is no such appeal of that kind of a decision, that the Attorney General, under the statutes that empower him, is authorized to settle litigation that the state's involved in. We think that was the right decision, and we think the Supreme Court hopefully will see it the same way.
If I could, I would hope that it would. It just strikes me that the Department of Law should be able to settle things just like any other litigant should. But, I mean, commonly a court will apply some level of scrutiny and assume that the parties are well represented and that they know what they're doing. That's what courts do.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I agree, and I think this is a great settlement for the state, and it means that development is going forward at Point Thompson, and that's a wonderful thing.
I think we agree. Representative Liddell.
I'm still trying to figure this out. My question is similar to that of Mr. Josephson. Was the intervener, the entity which appealed this, was he an intervener in the Point Thompson case?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, the plaintiff was involved in some of the administrative issues. The Point Thompson litigation involved a number of administrative appeals, and Superior Court, it went up to the Superior Court and back again to administrative levels, and then eventually ended up in the Supreme Court. It involved not only DNR, but an order of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So it was a multi-headed hydra, this litigation. But I believe that the plaintiff did participate in some of those administrative proceedings, but that wasn't the basis for challenging the settlement agreement. It was as a basically a member of the public who presumably had some misgivings about the agreement.
So I mean, you said that the court held that there was no, the Superior Court held that there was no jurisdiction. Did it also rule that there was no standing there? I actually don't think I've ever heard of somebody ever challenging a settlement agreement when they haven't been, you know, very involved a party in the litigation.
Right. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, there is that wasn't the state did not make a standing argument, and basically the state's, so that wasn't something that the court ruled on. What the state said is that this isn't something that's subject to an administrative appeal. It's not the type of administrative agency decision, and there are many types of administrative agency decisions that commissioners make that are subject to administrative appeals and on to Superior Court. Sometimes parties can assert that they're a public interest litigant, and that even if they weren't directly involved, that they have some kind of standing to appeal some decision of the department. But that wasn't the issue that the Superior Court was faced with in this case.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Continuing on.
The other major piece of work that our section does is Outer Continental Shelf litigation. And this is typically challenges by environmental groups to federal oil and gas lease sales or expiration plans that the former Minerals Management Service, now the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, that they would have jurisdiction over. So these are federal issues. There are challenges in federal court by environmental groups, typically based on environmental sort of issues under the National Environmental Policy Act relating to EISs or other things of that nature. The state does not always get involved in every case relating to those kind of issues, but with regard to the expiration that Shell was contemplating in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, our section did get involved in those cases. Basically, we were arguing to support the federal agency actions in conducting the lease sales, in approving the expiration plans, those kind of things. And other sections besides the oil and gas section have gotten involved in some of those issues, too. Again, supporting efforts to develop federal outer continental shelf oil and gas leases. And the courts have been respectful. They've allowed us to intervene. They've been respectful of the briefs that we've filed, and that's important for Alaska's future. We will not get production taxes or royalties from these federal leases, but it will bring jobs to Alaska. There may be property taxes associated with infrastructure that's on state land or within state jurisdiction. It will help to put more oil into the TAPS pipeline, which will reduce the TAPS tariff. The more oil that's in the pipeline, you spread the operating costs over more barrels of oil. So it brings the tariff down. It means that production from state lands, state royalties and production taxes, will go up because the tariff will be lower. So for all those reasons, federal Outer Continental Shelf oil development is very important to the state, and we monitor those cases and we intervene where we think it's appropriate to do so.
And you mentioned the fact that the state is not anticipated to get revenue from that directly, and of course that's an issue that we continue, I think, to work closely with our congressional delegation, because most states actually do get a share, but Alaska doesn't, and I know that's something that we're all very focused on. Of course, nothing.
Well, Madam Chair, you're right that in the Gulf of Mexico states that they have more generous. The way it works, of course, is it's state taxing jurisdiction up to 3 miles offshore. Between 3 and 6 miles, it's federal land, but the state gets 27% of the federal royalty under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, a federal statute. But beyond 6 miles, the state doesn't get any share of the federal royalty. It's more generous than that in some Gulf of Mexico states, and I know Senator Murkowski has worked on that, and hopefully that might change for Alaska in the future. But as the law currently is, that's how it sits.
We would very much like to be treated like the Gulf of Mexico, and that seems only fair. Representative Josephson. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schultz, when the state moved from a sort of a true production tax or severance tax model in 05 or 06, whenever that was, to PPT, the dissenters said, this will be a travesty. We can't keep up with the industry's accountants and auditors. They'll run circles around us. And your office will be swamped with challenges, as well as the revenue oil and gas division and its accountants. Has that happened?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I mean, you're certainly highlighting that it is a more complex production tax system than it was in the past, and the deduction of leasehold expenditures is something that those weren't deductible under the old gross tax. So you're certainly correct that it's a more complex tax than it was before. The Department of Revenue did hire audit masters to help with that. They do have, so in other words, they have augmented their staff to look at those kind of issues. The audits typically are several years out from the years. So in other words, like you said, the PPT started in 2006, ACES started in 2007. So as the audits of those years are completed, and if they're appealed, then we may see increased appeals that may affect my section. We probably will, because anytime you have a major change in the tax law, typically there's more administrative appeals until everyone understands the new rules. But I do think the Department of Revenue and their audit staff is capable of auditing these lease expenditures. They've geared up for it. I think it's something that the state can do. And I think the main thing is for the legislature to adopt a policy that they think is the right one to adopt. And then the administrative agencies that administer those taxes, if they need additional help, then the legislature can consider that. But that probably shouldn't be the driver of which system is picked. I think the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law are adaptable to either system.
Thank you.
Going back to OCS for just a second, with Shell actively working offshore and hopefully continuing to do so, do you see that adding? If Shell continues to move forward and, say, others continue to move forward in OCS, do you see that adding to the workload? Are there going to be additional types of cases that you would see coming through your office as they were to move into production?
Yeah. Chair Holmes, it's possible, but these are largely matters of federal agency actions and challenges would typically be in federal courts. So we do have an attorney that a lot of her practice in our section, not 100% by any means, but a significant part of her practice is working on OCS issues and also has worked on some NPRA permitting issues and other federal issues. So we do absorb that work into our section, mm-hmm. and at least to date, it hasn't, you know, we don't need additional attorney resources to do that. And, you know, we'll just have to see as time goes on. I don't necessarily anticipate that right now, yeah. but we'll see.
Yeah, just curious.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
The next thing I was going to cover is our use of outside counsel and experts, but we've kind of talked about that already, so you anticipated that one. So I think we've worked through the major issues that are in our section right now and the major clients and types of work that we do. You have this major litigation spreadsheet, and it basically we've talked about some of the cases on it already. Some of the other cases are different royalty issues that we have about interpreting state oil and gas leases. I've put the so-called ELF aggregation case mm-hmm. on this spreadsheet, which is a decision that the Department of Revenue made under the old gross production tax, the so-called, people referred to it as the ELF system, or because there was something called an economic limit factor, where the lower the production from a field, the lower the effective tax rate it would pay. In 2005, the Department of Revenue aggregated Prudhoe Bay and some of its satellites for purposes of this ELF-based tax, which had the effect of raising the effective tax rate on some of those satellites. Mm-hmm. And we just got a favorable result in that case out of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that's now in Superior Court. There's a lot of money at stake in that case. Even though it's only for a single year, there's hundreds of millions of dollars at issue. So that's one of the cases that we haven't talked about. Other than that, I think we have touched on most of the matters, if not by name, at least by category on this major litigation spreadsheet. If there's any questions that you have about anything we haven't talked about, please let me know. But that's the end of my presentation otherwise.
Okay. Well, I have a couple questions. I'll jump in and then others can join me. I think it's the last page, there's a reference to SINGSA, that's the cook inlet gas storage facility.
Yeah.
Can you tell me just a little bit about what that one is?
Madam Chair, that is a fascinating issue. Because it is actually fascinating, because there's kind of a split of authority around the country, but here is the issue. This is storage space. It's a depleted reservoir for storing gas, so that when there's high gas demand in South Central Alaska during the winter, gas can be pulled out of the storage facility to augment the ongoing production from the gas wells in Cook Inlet. And the Department of Natural Resources has leased space to SINGSA because the state owns the subsurface. But a municipality owns the surface estate. So it's a split estate. Municipality owns the surface, the state owns the subsurface. So here's the issue. Who gets to lease that space? I mean, the state says, our position is that the state does, since we own the subsurface rights. But there's a split of authority around the country. Sometimes in some states, the surface owner is the one that's entitled to lease the space. Sometimes it's the subsurface owner. So that's the issue in that litigation.
Do we have any precedent in this? I don't want you to get into giving away any tactics or anything, but is this an issue that's been addressed in the state of Alaska before?
Madam Chair, no, it hasn't.
So this is first impression.
First impression. Oh. And the case is, there's some, yes, and there, and there's, well, gas storage is a relatively, you know, recent thing in Alaska. It's, of course, more common in some parts of the lower 48, including Gulf of Mexico, you know, states. But the case is in very early discovery stages right now. Mm-hmm. So nothing dispositive is happening right now.
And, of course, not to kind of geek out on this, but, you know, a lot of other states that have oil and gas stuff have a very different structure. They don't necessarily separate the surface and subsurface rights. So that.
In a lot of other states, there's not as much. There's more private land owning where the surface and the subsurface is owned. Like in Texas, a rancher may own.
I was thinking of particularly.
Right. Where in Alaska, that's more unusual.
Representative Josephs.
Well, no, and I say this tongue-in-cheek, but thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I'm always sort of amazed because all local governments are creatures of the state, and the state, I know we have a viewing audience, so this is truly tongue-in-cheek, but the state could dissolve them, but I understand that we don't do that.
You're not recommending that we dissolve all but the municipalities just, and boroughs
no,
and
no.
Well, that would help our litigation position.
It would help with some of those property tax issues, too, wouldn't it?
That's true, too.
Thanks.
Are you waiting for a response?
Have you finished what you
were saying? I'm not sure I'm going to put
I said that I'm not advocating dissolving anything.
Yeah.
We like that over here.
Wow, all sorts of interesting bills are coming out of this meeting. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, that's where I was going. This is an issue that I hadn't thought about when we passed this legislation just a few years ago, how the revenues would be allocated. I don't recall that being specifically addressed in that bill. And I'm not asking for an answer. I'm kind of asking, just maybe this committee would want an executive session briefing on this.
Maybe we might want to follow up on this. It's got my attention.
I'll leave it at that.
I'm fascinated by this one.
We would be happy to provide that.
Okay. Yeah.
I wouldn't want to intrude on all the intelligence and brilliance of the House Resources Committee.
Well, there you go. There you go. A quick question, because it's not on here, because I know it's wrapped up, the BP corrosion case. My understanding is the BP corrosion case has been wrapped up and we're just in the final stages. Can you tell me where that is? I think there's maybe attorneys. Are there any issues still outstanding?
Madam Chair, that's actually a case that my section is not handling.
Oh, okay.
That's a case that's being handled by our environmental section. Okay. And my understanding, though, is that the arbitration has been completed and there was an award to the state. And other than that, I'm not very, don't know much about that case.
Okay. We'll let you off the hook on that one. Let's see. Other areas of interest? Other questions?
I have a question for Mr. Cantor, but only after Mr. Schultz.
All right, Representative Grunberg.
I assume that there are a relatively small number of attorneys nationally and in Alaska who practice in this area. Do you have any problems, or have you had any problems with conflicts of interest, people having worked on one thing or another and now changing positions or whatever, either within your department or on the other side, because of the small number of people who deal with this?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you're certainly right that there can be conflicts from time to time, but the firms that we work with, if they're interested in representing a client Where there might be a potential conflict, we have a mechanism at the Department of Law to evaluate those conflicts. We can waive the conflict if we don't think that it in any way impairs the state's interest. Or we can decline to waive it if we think that it might. And so that's something we look at on a case-by-case basis. The firms do, from time to time, send us requests to waive potential conflicts, and we evaluate those carefully.
In the area of law that I practiced, which was known as affectionately the Fang and Claw School of Law, family law, occasionally we would find people who would bomb attorneys, try to disqualify everybody. And I've been in litigation that has involved that. Is that a problem in your area of law?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, no, I can't say that it has been a problem. And some of our contract counsel have represented us for a number of years, and you know, they make that choice not to, to represent someone that there might be a conflict.
I'm glad you're more civilized. Thank you.
Any other questions? No? I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for being here today. That's very informative, at least for me, and hopefully for others. Any parting thoughts before we let you off the hot seat?
No, but thank you for letting me be here today.
And Jim, with your permission, Mr. Cantor, would you join us for a second? Sounds like we might have a question or two for you since we got a few minutes left.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair, Deputy Attorney General, I guess, Cantor. Over the historically, there's always been a lot of tension between a handful of departments of who is going to have dominion over oil and gas issues, litigation, and development. So it's always been revenue and DNR and law, sometimes even being a weak partner at times. Don't see a lot of horsepower or work ethic out of revenue. So where is the tension now? Who is really the leader, or with a former attorney general now at DNR? Is there a lot of crossover? Can you give us a handle of how these issues are cross-pollinated?
Through the chair, I guess I see a lot of cooperation and communication between the departments. And so I don't see that kind of tension you're referring to that may have happened in the past.
Is it an inaccurate assessment that there's been historical tension in the past?
I wouldn't want to bet on the past.
I'll leave it at that.
No. Any other questions while we have Mr. Cantor in front of us? Okay. Well, then, thank you very much. And we have coming up next Tuesday, we are scheduled, our next meeting's next Tuesday, same time, same place. We're going to be going over the increment requests in the fiscal year 14 budget. And with that, thank you for being here today, and we're adjourned at 11:45.